Empire podcast this week, we have Primo Franco as the disaster artists Dave and James pop into the pod booth, while Ferdinand's John Cena picks his classic Cena. Yes, this is where the magic happens. All that and more on the movie podcast that doesn't think Twin Peaks Season 3 is the second greatest film of the year, but does think it's the tastiest meal we've eaten this year. That Blu-ray. A bit jagged, get caught in the teeth, but it's so tasty. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I am joined by two colleagues. Yes, two colleagues. We're back to normal of such lethal cunning. First up is our geek queen, a lady who is, I imagine, quite excited about a newcomer on the London theatre scene. I am, of course, talking about Glengarry Glen Ross, starring Christian Slater and Chris Marshall out of My Family in the role made famous in the film by an actor by Christopher Plummer. Hey, Helen, you excited about that?
Super excited, Chris. That's definitely the most exciting thing happening on the London stage this week.
There's no doubt about it. Tickets are just £15 thanks to an offer in Time, thanks to an offer in a rival magazine. And I might take a time out later on and take advantage of that offer and go along for £15 per seat. Is there anything else that's happening in the London theatre scene?
I can't imagine that there's any like world-class musicals that are the greatest musical of our time opening like yesterday.
I'm just going to stop you.
She's talking about Cats, right?
Oh, good Lord, no.
Jellicle cats. What a load of shit. if you just excuse me a second, James, I'll introduce you in a second. I've just got to enter this lottery to buy tickets for £10 to Hamilton, which has just opened.
Hamilton's open!
Oh, Hamilton's open! Oh, my God!
Yes, I'm going to see it on the 15th. Woo!
Of
December.
Next Friday?
Yes.
That's amazing.
What time will this be for you? This is the third time? Second time?
This is only the second time. Of course, the first time I saw it was on Broadway with the entire original cast, James. But, you know.
I do feel a little bit like if Lin-Manuel Miranda's not in it,
this is James
I don't
Dyer.
Want to see it.
This is James Dyer, by the way, and something about West Wing. Continue.
Fantastic.
But of course, it was segues nicely into the fact that Lin-Manuel Miranda is in fact a big fan of the West Wing, and did a West Wing rap called "What's Next," which you can find on YouTube, and I highly recommend.
He's a big fan of everything good.
Yes, he is. I
was just watching
the line, "You ain't getting Uncle Fluffy, motherfucker," which is lyricism at its best.
I was actually watching him last night in Fatwa the musical, which appeared in Curb Your Enthusiasm. Yes, and he performs a number with F. Murray Abraham. He plays Salman Rushdie.
Which season is that?
With F. Murray Abraham as an Ayatollah.
That's amazing. Which season is that? Because I'm up to
season 5. I don't know.
Five.
I watched it on YouTube, so.
Okay.
Extraordinary.
But if he's in Curb, it must be this season, right? Because otherwise Lin-Manuel Miranda wouldn't be famous enough to have been in
well,
it beforehand.
He wrote... I mean, he already won Emmy a few years ago for writing the Tony's big number. Do you remember Make It Bigger? It was a Neil Patrick Harris number. It was fantastic.
What's your mental process you're going through there when you're going, did he win it? And then you start going...
Emmy, Grammy. I went Emmy, Grammy, Tony, Oscar.
But are you saying it out loud inside your head? Is that what you're doing?
I was saying it out loud in real life, Chris.
You were mumbling it.
Yeah.
But in your head, were you going, Emmy? Or
no?
That's an interesting
mumbling it.
It is very exciting that Hamilton is here. I am trying to get tickets. There's a £10 lottery every day. My wife and I, drinking game, are trying to apply separately. So far, unsuccessful. So far, unsuccessfully. He's quite wily, like his old man.
I thought you had tickets.
Yeah, but I want to get the £10 tickets.
Ah, fine.
Rather than the expensive tickets that I bought. And anyway, that's like next month. And you want to see it now.
Of course.
When there are still in previews and forgetting the words and stuff.
They won't be forgetting the words.
Yeah.
They'll be really good.
And so the guy would go, I'm not going to throw it in there. Oh no, I've blanked. Ah!
I don't think that's likely to happen. I think they're
Why
pretty
did you go
professional.
For Cartman there?
I don't know. Is Lin-Manuel Miranda in it?
He is in the country. He has been overseeing the final stages of rehearsals.
Well, that's much the same thing.
I mean, it is. They have his seal of approval, James. So, you know, a little bit less Lin-Manuel Miranda snobbery.
Isn't that
would be
a
nice.
Bit like the latter-day Alex Cross books, where they have James Patterson's approval, but really it's the work he's writing them?
You know what? If you want to be this much of a snob about seeing a musical that you already know you like, that's fine. Okay. I just feel like you're missing out, maybe.
Fine. As you wish.
Anywho,
we should have a question. And this week's question comes to us via Twitter, and it is from basically, everybody on the internet, and it is quite simply, is Die Hard a Christmas movie? And this isn't something that's been specifically asked to the podcast, but it's something I've certainly seen an awful lot, and I've got a bit of a bee in my bonnet about this.
Sure.
I think you two as well, James. Helen, where do you stand on this? Is Die Hard a Christmas movie?
I mean, sure, but it's not like the Christmassiest Christmas movie. Like it, this whole thing. Oh, I actually like my favorite Christmas movie is Die Hard because I'm so cool. Like,
James,
whatever.
Get out the PowerPoint presentation. Helen needs to be corrected.
It's a movie that takes place at Christmas.
Helen, we are both professionals. This is personal.
Okay.
No, it's just anyone who doesn't think Die Hard is a Christmas movie, A, has no soul, and B, should be thrown off the top of the Nakatomi Plaza.
Well, I think a Christmas movie has to be in some way about Christmas.
This is about Christmas. There's a teddy bear. It's a present. There's a tree. People give gifts. It is the Yule spirit in every way.
You didn't say it's a time of miracles, which I think is a massive oversight
it's
on
Christmas,
your part.
Theo. It's a time of miracles, so be of good cheer and accept that this
is
important.
I didn't
Christmas
actually
movie.
Deny it was a Christmas movie. I would refer you back to my earlier statement.
This is true.
What I said
you're
is...
You're arguing with Helen for argument's sake.
I know. It contains the words ho, ho, ho.
I mean, you know, so do my initials, but, like, what does that have to do with anything? I just think that the people who... Some of the worst people in the world go, actually, my favourite Christmas movie is Die Hard. Bet you didn't know there was a Christmas movie.
Also,
ha, 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 ha.
Some of the best people in the world.
Yeah, two of the very best people in the world. And actually, I don't even think it is the best Christmas movie ever made, which is weird because it's one of the best movies ever made, but it's not National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
That's because it's not very Christmassy. Like, so I will allow it as a Christmas movie. I will allow it as a great movie. Obviously, I'm not an idiot.
This is where
I'm
going to have to get the PowerPoint out.
The greatest Christmas movie. This is the point, people.
It is a movie that is bedecked with Christmas jewels. It is a movie that is as Christmassy as Scrooge. It is as Christmassy as Ant and Dec doing something Christmassy at Christmas, which I'm sure is something that they do. I don't really know. I don't watch ITV. But... People have been saying to me, like, a lot of people are correct. The noted historian and author Greg Jenner is someone who's in my camp, and he is saying that, yes, this is a Christmas movie. John Rain as well, Mr. Ken Shabby on Twitter, is also in my camp. This is a Christmas movie. But a lot of people have been saying to me recently, it's a movie that takes place at Christmas. It's not the same thing. Wrong! Die Hard is not accidentally set at Christmas. It is not like John McTiernan got on set and the set decorator had gone, I didn't really know what to do, Mr. McTiernan, so I just stuck a Christmas tree there. And John McTiernan goes, well, I guess this is a Christmas movie now. Okay, this is a movie that is entirely based around Christmas and the idea that Christmas is an agent of change. And in many ways, Hans Gruber is the Scrooge of this movie, and he is changed by the ghost of Christmas, past,
changed
present,
from,
and
no,
future.
Sorry, no.
He's
changed,
living,
I'm sorry,
into
he's
dead.
Dead. He undergoes a change of heart in the 30 seconds it takes him to drop from the top floor of the Nakatomi Plaza.
You have literally no evidence
who
of that.
Who among us hasn't on Christmas Day sat down with a beloved relative who won't give us our present and said, I'm going to count...
I mean, literally, I think we know the answer to that is one, James, and it's you.
There not be a fraud.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Takagi.
I'm not saying, and I would remind you again, I haven't argued that it isn't a Christmas movie. I'm not saying it's not set at Christmas on purpose. Of course it's set at Christmas on purpose.
Yeah.
But
why is it
that doesn't
Christmas
make it the most Christmassy movie. This is an insane point to take.
It is set, okay. The whole plot revolves around a Christmas party. The whole reason that the Nakatomi Plaza is not that well defended is because it's Christmas and people have knocked off. So Hans Gruber and his gang of elves, that's my understanding anyway.
Well,
that
sounds,
right?
See, that immediately sounds anti-Christmas. You're saying people are more vulnerable at Christmas because the security's gone home early to have some turkey.
Because they're having a heartwarming Christmas family.
Yes, and you're saying, what you're saying is that, you know, that is something that is a terrifying prospect because it means that, you know, robbers posing as terrorists
not for
will.
Them. They're loving it. They're at home. Having a lovely Christmas dinner with their family. Meanwhile, yes, the
but they're
going to
be potentially out of work come December 26th because, you know, Nakatomi Tower has presumably out of action for quite some time until the structural engineers get in to ensure that everything is still safe.
Well, Helen, I got news for you. I'm really, really sorry, but bad things happen at Christmas. Den and Angie got divorced on Christmas Day. Do you remember that?
I remember Gremlins. I know bad things happen at Christmas.
Gremlins, also a great Christmas movie.
I'm not talking about even not just the Gremlins themselves, but, you know, Phoebe Cates' dad.
We could all agree the second greatest Christmas movie is Die Hard 2.
I mean, Die Hard 2 is great. Again, I have to question your reasoning.
See, for me, Die Hard 2 is more in the second camp. That is a movie that just happens to take place at Christmas, but Christmas actually is integral to the plot of Die Hard. The very end, the only reason he can shoot Hans Gruber is because he has sellotaped the gun to his shoulder
with
using
Christmas
sellotape.
And he kills Gruber with a Christmas present.
No, no, but in the second one, you have snow, for a start, much more Christmassy. People wearing fur-trimmed hoods, very Christmassy. And also
wintry.
the lighting of a symbolic fire.
Right,
it's like the star leading the wise men to the stable, but instead of that, it's a giant flame leading the circling planes to safety. It's very Christmassy.
So you're saying that Die Hard 2 heralds the birth of the second coming of our Lord Savior Jesus Christ?
Well, look at the initials if you leave out the M.
Oh my God, are you saying that? Wait a second. Oh my God, Jai Courtney. Jai Courtney. It's all there. The clues are all there somehow.
All the pieces matter, Chris.
But there you go. Officially, Helen has agreed with us 100%. The Die Hard is the crismiest Christmas movie of all time, and in many ways a sly retelling of A Christmas Carol with Hans Gruber playing Scrooge and the three ghosts.
For all naysayers, take this under advisement, Joe.
Good Lord.
Right, so there you go. That's the internet's question answered to the internet satisfaction. If you do want to get in touch with us with a genuine question, you can do so via a number of methods. There is, of course, Twitter, where we're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag, please, Empire Podcast, or chances are we will not see it. There's Facebook, where we are Empire Magazine. And there is, of course, what's the other one? Email, where we're podcast@empireonline.com. All right, time now for this week's first guest. He is a terrifying man mountain, but enough about James Dyer. So is John Cena, who is one of the world's most famous wrestlers, along with Giant Haystacks and Big Daddy. He's quite popular, isn't he, James?
He's the doctor of thugonomics.
See, I don't know what that means, and I'm glad I didn't interview him. Because that's all I've been saying all week. You go, oh, we got John Cena, and you go, he's a doctor of thugonomics, and genuinely lost to me, mate.
No, he has a PhD and everything, in thugonomics. This is actually true. It's not true.
Sounds like a knockoff degree you can get from one of those. You know, it's like Saul Goodman's law doctorate.
Yeah, it's a lot like that.
Okay. But he's made the move to movies recently. Of course, he was in action films like The Marine and 12 Rounds. But of course, he made a bit of a comedic impact in Trainwreck.
Indeed,
and you'll be discussing that with him later on. He is lending his voice to Ferdinand, which is an animated movie which comes out on the 15th, I believe.
It does come out on the Saturday, weirdly, which is either the 15th or 16th.
16th. I know, because I'm seeing Hamilton on the 15th. Have I mentioned it? Probably not.
Oh, good God. So the day after Helen sees Hamilton, you can all go and see Ferdinand.
Yeah, set your watches. So Ferdinand's coming out next week, but James went along to speak to John Cena this week and had a merry old chat about a great many things. Fair?
Yes. Also, this has relevance to Franco as well. So there's a whole theme in this podcast.
Oh, wow. Okay. And along the way, you asked him to choose a classic scene.
A classic scene. Yes, this is a bit that happens. And I thought I was very proud of myself for not correcting him for getting the quote and indeed the film wrong. But I genuinely, despite the couple of factual errors, I thought it was a good pick.
Well, I'm intrigued. I'm intrigued to find out what it is, even though, of course, I already know. Here it is. John Cena talking to James Dyer. Enjoy.
We have a very special guest today on the Empire podcast. He is the voice of Ferdinand the Bull. He is one of the biggest stars in wrestling, and his name is John Cena. How are you, sir?
That's very intimate of you. Appreciate it. Here we are.
There you go. What's it like to be a meme?
It's something that's granted me extension of my life as a storyteller. It's introduced me to a whole new generation of people, and as long as you're comfortable with being the butt of the joke, which is an awesome exercise and not taking life too serious, it's a really cool thing.
It is. And of course, you are the voice of Ferdinand the Bull. Yep. I learned a thing about Ferdinand recently. Did you know this? That Ferdinand the Bull, the book, is possibly the most controversial children's book in history.
Yes. Originally banned in Spain, Germany, and Italy, I believe.
I know. It's nuts, isn't it? Because Franco thought it was pacifist propaganda?
Yes.
Hitler burned every copy of it in Nazi Germany.
Yep.
And I read they also printed something like 30,000 copies of it after the war and gave them out in Germany to kind of promote peace as well.
Yeah. So what a a strong enough message to develop opinions like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's about time it was made into a movie, and what a movie it is.
Yeah, no, it's great stuff. It's I think it's been accused of promoting communism, fascism, democracy, and anarchism, which is an interesting portfolio for a book.
Amazing that people can bring a bunch of that stuff away from a few short pages.
Well, quite, yeah. So, I mean, how did you get involved in it? Was it a book you knew as a kid? What
it was a book I was aware of because it's been showcased in entertainment. The scene I keep referencing is from Blindside when Sandra Bullock references Ferdinand.
Yes, indeed.
So I love movies about sports. I watched that movie a bunch, so I knew of the story. And she explains the whole story.
Yeah.
But I never read the book until after I did the movie. I never watched the short animated until after I did the movie. I just didn't want to go into it with a closed-minded approach that I have to do something some way. So I just kind of did the voice, and we had a ton of fun doing it. And then I began to get into the book, and the story is beautiful.
Mm. No, it's a lovely story, isn't it? It's a bull, essentially, who prefers smelling flowers to fighting other bulls.
Yeah.
So it's kind of be yourself, you know, don't let people tell you what to be.
Yeah.
But this adaptation is more of an adventure, isn't it? It's not sort of as clear-cut, because the book is kind of a very simple fable, isn't it? Whereas there's a whole lot more going on in this
Well,
version.
To take a short story, as Carlos Saldana will say, with a big message, to make it a feature, you have to expand on it.
Yeah.
And I think they did a great job of expanding on the universe, certainly making it more adventurous, a bunch more fun. There's a bunch of new characters. But at the same time, it didn't lose the backbone message of the book. I think it told that story pretty well.
Yeah, so you have the fable, but you also have a dance-off between three horses and some bulls.
Yep.
So, you know.
Exactly.
Something for everyone.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Ferdinand in this, he's the biggest, he's the strongest bull on the farm. This is presumably a situation you're reasonably familiar with. You've been wrestling for, what is it, 18 years now?
15. For on TV for WWE, about 15.
Wow, yeah. That's absolutely nuts. I mean, how did you first get into the sport as a fan?
Just as a young kid, WWE just caught fire in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
It was a perfect storm of, you know, culture at the time and the grandiose performances and the larger-than-life superstars. And as a young kid, I just gravitated towards it. I thought these were real-life superhero folks and just was enamored by it as a kid.
Yeah. I mean, we were roughly the same age, so I imagine it was a similar era. Were you a Hulkamaniac?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As pretty much every young person was, if you could watch WWE at the time and you saw a broadcast, you gravitated towards Hulk Hogan.
I'll be honest, I was more of an Ultimate Warrior guy.
Well, he came along a little bit later.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw my first WWE match in
83. Oh, wow. Okay, that was early.
So Hulk was around a long time before the Ultimate Warrior came through.
Because it was, I think, I got into about 88, I would say.
Yeah,
it took a little longer to get over
here.
But yeah, so okay, we had a whole thing there. It was an interesting era, though, wasn't it? Like, it was very, I mean, it's always larger than life, but in the 80s, you know, the costumes, the names, you know, big boss man.
If you look at the 80s in general, the 80s are larger than life.
Yeah.
And I think it's, I look at those characters, and yes, we can look back and be like, man, they were just remedial, and they were what they were. But at the same time, what an easy way to define who you are. Like, in a very wrestling rabbit hole question, a lot of the struggle that guys go through nowadays is being able to define themselves to the audience.
Mm.
But I know the big boss man dressed in a police uniform coming down to the song Hard Time is either a good cop or a bad cop.
It's very true. No, I loved all that stuff. I thought it was amazing. I mean, you never got to wrestle Hulk, did you?
I never got to wrestle Hulk. I was on his team once.
Oh, really?
It was myself, Shawn Michaels, and Hulk Hogan. And I was the grown adult looking like a spoiled child, grinning from ear to ear. I don't think I did anything. I just watched my idols go in and make magic.
That's amazing. Sorry, I think The Rock got to wrestle Hulk when he won.
Yes.
We spoke about this once
before. And I believe one of the greatest matches of all time.
Really?
Yes.
I don't think I've seen it.
When you watch it back, it depends. Like, I always grade good entertainment for how the audience perceives it.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for a chess battle of two technical aficionados, it is not that. But what you do see is the iconic photo of a generation staring at a generation and 75,000 people going nuts. you can, as Gorilla Monsoon would say, you could feel the electricity.
Yes.
Like, it's a pretty amazing moment.
Oh, Gorilla Monsoon was amazing. I remember, God,
it was really good.
I feel really old. Yeah, I love that stuff. I remember I watched it, I think, pretty much up to, I want to say, SummerSlam 91 was, do you remember that? I'm just nerding out here. Remember the Ultimate Warrior lost his belt to Sergeant Slaughter. This was a big traumatic event in my childhood. And then they had the rematch with Macho King and SummerSlam 91. I think that was the last time that I kind of properly sat down with all my friends and we sat down and watched it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of an amazing time. So if you could have wrestled anyone in the history of the WWE / WWF, would it have been Hulk? Was that who you'd have chosen?
You know, there is a large amount of mystique and reputation to Andre the Giant.
Yes.
And I think just for the sheer, I guess, wanting to be reviewed and accepted or denied by my peers, either way, he was the measuring stick. Like, as the saying would go, if Andre liked you, you were all right, and if not, you had a tough road ahead.
Yeah,
so just a monster of a man in the ring, but a wonderful character outside it as well.
Yeah, I'd heard that. Are you a Princess Bride fan?
Anybody want a peanut?
I think say that as a yes.
The Princess Bride is a wonderful story as well.
Yeah. It's, I mean, what are your go-to films? What are the films that really, you know,
I don't, as far as go-to films, I think there's so many great movies out there and so many great movies that come out every year.
Mm.
I gravitate towards like 80s comedies, Caddyshack, Back to School.
Yes.
I mean, and pretty much anything done in the 80s, that stupid, like Animal House, I love. But at the same time, it's not that, I mean, I love comedies nowadays too. Yeah. So it's very difficult to choose like, well, these are the movies I always watch. I'm always watching more and more movies, I think, just like everybody else.
The 80s was a very special time for film generally, whether it be action, whether it be comedy. You don't quite get those kind of films these days.
Just because culture changes.
Yeah.
Like it was kind of all open forum and risky and lawless and pushing the limits, and culture was evolving as well. We began to openly deal with issues like race and stuff like that. So you see, you know, that stuff addressed in a comedic sense. Mm-hmm. It was just the backbone of a lot of films, but like we've evolved as a culture more now. So it's there's a different movie making process. So I mean, it's not that it's worse or better, and we all, in a very nostalgic sense, look back on greener pastures, but there's some really good stuff out there now, like Ferdinand. Go see
it. Yes, there is Ferdinand, which opens in December, I want to say the 16th, doesn't it?
That's correct. Saturday
16th over
that
here,
correct.
2 days after The Last Jedi, so, you know.
Here's guns. I'm very aware that people are excited for the Star Wars franchise. I'll say this. I would rather be a movie playing in a theater where I know there's a ton of people who have a chance to look at Ferdinand and be like, man, I'll check that out.
Yeah.
Then be a great movie is the only release, and not a lot of folks go to the theater. You
Absolutely.
Know, those box office weekends where you see, like, everybody stayed in, you don't really set yourself up for a lot of people wanting to see and enjoy the movie. Mm. I know a ton of people are going to the movies for Star Wars.
Yes, they will.
So maybe a few people who want to see Star Wars either check out Ferdinand or come back to the theater next week to check out Ferdinand.
Your first starring film was The Marine, wasn't it? That was 2006.
Yeah.
I mean, what was that like for you? I mean, to headline a movie for the first time,
I didn't know what I was doing. No, I mean it. It was not supposed to be my movie in the first place.
Really?
It was written for another WWE superstar, and they kind of canceled.
Yeah.
So they were already in pre-production. They were like 14 days away from shooting, and I got called into an office and said, "You're going to Australia, kid. You're going to make this movie." Okay. And my initial attraction to wanting to make movies was to further the business model of the business that I love.
Yeah.
And that's WWE. That's a wrong way to go about making movies, because movies it's not the stock market. It's not black and white business. It's a creative business, just like WWE. That's why there's intangibles to define success and failure. You have to be passionate. You have to be creative. So The Marine was a financial success, but I didn't know what I was doing. And the whole time I was there, I'm half a world away, and Australia was a beautiful place, but I just longed to get back to the ring. And every movie thereafter, movie pace is a lot slower.
Yeah.
WWE life is fast. That was right as I was steamrolling into this wonderful phase of my life where, like, everything's going a million miles an hour, and here I'm sitting doing nothing, waiting on shots and doing this. So I just thought a better use of my time would be like, well, I got to go back to the ring. Fast forward 10 years, a decade later, where I've been telling the same story about the same character over and over and over again, which I will do every single night because I still have that same passion for it. But when you do that repeatedly, when you repeatedly play your hits, when AC/DC plays Thunderstruck for the 100,000th time, they do it because they love it. And you continue to ask yourself, well, why do I love it? And I think at 26 or 27, I can be like, well, it's the fast life. It's amazing. Like, I love WWE as a 40-year-old man because I love telling stories. And that's what movies are. You tell stories. And it takes a different perspective. It takes a different type of performance, especially with a voice role. But it's still all just telling stories, man. So movies, I think now and I'm very grateful and fortunate that many people aren't given a first chance, let alone a second one. So I'm only choosing stuff that when I go away, I know that I'm not just going away to film the movie. I'm coming to do stuff like this, which if you don't like what you're in, this is a root canal. But if you do like what you're in, we can sit and I'll waste all the data you got on the recorder talking about how awesome the process was. So these last few years have been really fun. And at the same time, it's cool to see an ever-changing dynamic in the WWE, how they adapt to all the things that are going on with my life. Like, it's all really cool to sit back and step outside of what's going on and long lens it and see, like, whoa, this is pretty cool, you know? And it's got its ups and downs, and you win some, you lose some, but everything I do, I put my heart and soul into.
It's an interesting thing. It's like being the star of a film is a kind of a big deal, but I imagine it's nothing compared to being like a ring star, like the immediacy of being there with the crowd. There must be nothing quite like that.
It's unless you've been there, and I don't mean seen it, like been in the ring.
Yeah,
it's undescribable.
I'm sure
it's just not describable. It's something that has kept me going back to get my ass whipped for 15 years, and I'm still just getting warmed up.
It's incredible. I must admit, I tried out a number of moves on both willing and unwilling classmates at school during the 80s. It's a lot harder than it looks.
Yeah, it is. I guess that's why you're put in special company when you're successful at it.
Yeah. I mean, from a technical point of view, what's the hardest stuff you do in the ring? Like, is there a particular... I mean, or is
no,
it all
no, it's just being comfortable enough to do the things you want to do.
Yeah.
It's a showcase of skill. It's a showcase of character. You use your tools to tell a story. So the toughest thing is understanding who you're telling a story to. We have a global audience that stretches from very young to very old and all in between. You can never please everybody. So it's very difficult to sometimes interpret the environment and try to use your tools to tell that story. That's the toughest thing. Physical stuff is fun. You get to jump around and be a kid. You know, that's fun. But it's understanding the element and trying to tell that story that's really difficult.
Yeah. I mean, there's, in some ways, rightly or wrongly, there's a kind of a stigma, I guess, attached to people who move from wrestling into film. Although The Rock's done it very successfully. Dave Bautista's done it very successfully. Hulk Hogan kind of never really did.
Yeah.
But you've really taken to this. And I think Trainwreck in particular, I mean, you're like the breakout star of that film. I mean, the scenes you have in that are the funniest scenes in the film. In particular, like the sex scene you have with Amy Schumer is hilarious. I mean, what was that like to shoot? I mean, it's your first comedy, which has got to be pretty intimidating, and you're bare-ass naked throughout the whole scene.
I think it wasn't a big deal about, like, okay, in a very real sense, it's being comfortable in your own skin.
Yeah.
And having faith in the people around you. I am wearing a towel. That's it. And I'm supposed to simulate awkward sex with Amy Schumer.
Yeah.
She was extremely understanding and kind and kind of let me, like, tell my own jokes and be weird. And Judd is over there encouraging me to be even weirder. So when you are in the, and they tried to be nice. I remember when they started filming that, they're like, it's a closed set. And I didn't know what Amy was going to be wearing or whatever. But, like, she was clothed, taken care of. I'm in a towel. So I just said, forget it. Like, this is it. Okay, I'm here.
Yeah.
And a closed set became, like, sold out in a matter of 10 minutes. You know, a camera, and then a camera op, and then audio, and then another camera, and then another two people, and then catering's in there before you know it. And, like, everybody's watching you. So I think it's the ability to just not be ashamed of yourself, be able to laugh at yourself, because I believe a lot of comedy is putting our hardships out there and making light of it. And then other people can relate, so they laugh too.
Yeah,
it was just having faith in the funny folks around me, and kudos to them because they never were like, "Oh, that joke sucked," even when a lot of them did. So you only saw the really funny stuff. What you didn't see is a lot of the stuff that didn't make it. But had they ever once been like, oh, "What are you doing here?" I'd have shut down, shut up, been in a robe. Like, it was. They created an environment to thrive.
Yeah,
it was awesome.
That's kind of improv in a nutshell, though, isn't it? Because Judd's very big on letting people kind of freestyle and just using the takes that work.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've kind of got to encourage that.
It takes a lot. It takes a lot of patience, and certainly he obviously sees something in the people he picks, because he just, you know, he does an incredible job casting these people. But like, he's very easy to work with, and like I said, it's a it could be something very intimidating. He is not that way at all. He brings out the best in you. Like, he's Amy as well. Like, it was just a fun environment to be in.
Yeah, no, so it's a very fun film. Particularly the cinema scene is another really good one.
And once again, really something that wasn't supposed to go that way, but like, after being in there for a while and rolling a lot of film, that's what we got. So. Glad everybody enjoyed it.
One thing that we do in the magazine, we have a regular called Classic Scene, which kind of goes to the back of the magazine, and essentially someone in the film industry will pick a scene which means a lot to them, whether it be the greatest scene in cinema or just one they really like as well. I'd like to try a variation on that, classic scene, if you will.
Okay.
Is there a particular scene in movies that you love that would be your standout, that you would pick for this page?
This one, I think, just because of what it is. So I know there's a... this is going to, so Fox people are going to string me up, but guys, walk with me here.
Yep.
So there's a scene in episode one of Star Wars, which the Star Wars people are now on my case because they all hated episode one. But it was a scene in the Democratic Hall where they openly give power to the Emperor.
Yes.
And there's a moment where the phrase, so this is how democracy dies. It is simply just given away. And I loved that. That one moment, that fleeting, wasted line in the enormous story arc of Star Wars, lighting the fire for this empire and the good versus evil and art imitating life in some ways.
Damned right, yeah.
So I really thought that was special, and that's... the gift of a brilliant filmmaker to be able to try and touch all the bases, but at the same time send those subtle little messages that I thought was very special.
It's a fantastic scene. Episode one has its issues, but it also has, as you say, moments of genius in it.
It does.
I mean, that in particular is chilling.
And I'm not too critical a person. I just watch, and if I enjoy the ride, I enjoy the ride.
Yeah.
And that was one that stuck out in my head. There's a few more, but I think just because of... where I'm, you know, I like that one. I like that one.
That's a good shout. Presumably you'll be going to see The Last Jedi.
What's that?
Presumably you'll be going to see The Last Jedi.
Not when it's out in theaters. I will wait. Because I will only be seeing Ferdinand.
Always on message. Good stuff. No, Ferdinand, counter-programming to The Last Jedi. But there's room to see both, isn't there? Go and see one. Go and see
no,
one. See
and, them both. And what a great time for a movie to be out. Ever since, I believe, you know... Halloween kind of started to kick it off at Thanksgiving. Mm. The box offices, people have been going back to the movies. And I think that's key to making a successful movie. Yes, there are movies that are going to do financially better than every other movie. That's why there's, you know, one, two, whatever.
Yeah.
But the more people that go to the movies, and Star Wars has tremendous drawing power. I relate it to WWE, the match of Hulk Hogan versus Andre the Giant, the one that 95,000 people went to the Superdome to see. So many people on that card talk about Ricky Steamboat, Randy Savage, the match before. So because they did the greatest that they could and they essentially stole the show with a wonderful performance. So everybody could be going to see one thing and then be drawn to see something else and be surprised with a bunch of good movies. And that's what's going to happen with Ferdinand.
That's an astonishing analogy. So Ferdinand is the Ricky Steamboat of the holiday season.
Ricky Steamboat, yes. Randy Savage.
Absolutely. And on that note, John Cena, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, man.
A pleasure.
So that was John Cena there choosing his classic Cena. That's the only time we'll ever be able to use that.
Have you ever seen the unexpected John Cena meme? No?
I saw it in Trainwreck. Isn't that what you were talking about?
It's a modern-day Rick Ross. I referenced it when I first speak to him in the interview, but you'll see like a video on the internet with something really poignant, and then at the end you'll just hear this voice go, "And his name is John Cena!" And then it plays his music from The Ring. So it's
sure.
It's a more brawny Rickroll.
Wow. Okay. And good choice of movie. Eventually, an interesting one. So that is Revenge of the Sith. That scene is actually from Revenge of the Sith.
It is, and the line is, "This is how democracy dies," with thunderous applause.
But apart from that, it was tip top.
Yeah.
Yeah. All good. All right. Let's talk now about the week's movie news, of which I would say there has been a fair old glut. There's been lots of stuff happening. Where do we want to start, and when do we want to start there?
Shall we start with good news for Dexter Fletcher?
Bad news for Bryan Singer?
I think we should. Bryan Singer was fired publicly.
We will not let creative... him go. Let him go! Sorry.
Not creative differences.
Out of a canon.
Not a departure of ways. Not literally that way, okay. I apologise. From Bohemian Rhapsody, which is the Queen movie, as in Freddie Mercury, not as in The Crown. And he has been replaced by Eddie the Eagle's Dexter Fletcher, who's taking over.
Had he been replaced by Eddie the Eagle now?
No, that would be a surprise.
You had my attention. Now you have my curiosity. Or is it the other way around? I can never remember.
Yes, it doesn't make any sense, that quote, but people seem to like it. But it is good news that the film's going ahead, because all the word has been that Rami Malek's performance as Freddie Mercury is fantastic. He certainly looks the part. They've got a really good cast together, Ben Hardy, Joseph Mazzello, and Gwilym Lee as well. So, you know, it sounds good. It's planned for Christmas Day next year in the US, and hopefully Fletcher will be able to make the date. It was a bit of a shock story. I mean,
this is a bit of a shock story, isn't it? Because this doesn't often happen. So,
no.
Bryan Singer was, why was he fired?
He was fired for basically, it seemed to be not turning up to work, essentially. He didn't really come back from his Thanksgiving break.
So, yeah.
And there was a little bit of, there were certainly reports of sort of inconsistent working practices, essentially.
Dexter Fletcher was attached to direct this movie initially back in the day and has proved himself at the helm of a musical with the very, very lovely Sunshine and Leith.
Yeah.
Is also attached to another musical, Rocket Man, the Elton John biopic, which I hope happens, with Taron Egerton. I think it's a good choice, a solid choice. It's intriguing, with 3 weeks left of filming, and this isn't a case, of course, like the Star Wars, the Han Solo situation.
Yeah.
It is intriguing to see further developments in this case, if anything shall arise over the next few weeks. So there we go. Keep our eyes on that one. Anything else happening? Just loads of things.
Star Trek. Very exciting Star Trek news. Quentin Tarantino's pitched a story, a concept, an idea, a thought.
Yeah. What?
I know. Nuts, isn't it? That was my reaction. I was like, what? My understanding is he has no intention of directing this. That it's more likely he'll take a story credit and maybe a producing credit.
Because it was reported as directing for a minute there.
Yeah, but I don't think that's actually accurate.
Okay,
so he's pitched an idea. They've put together a writer's room to kind of flesh it out. I mean, God only knows what the idea is.
Mm.
But, I mean, the mind boggles, doesn't it?
I think a writer's room is probably safe, because the way that the world responded to one use of the F-bomb in Discovery, you know, you have to worry about what a Quentin Tarantino Star Trek would sound like.
Literally can't think of anything I'd want to see more.
My mind is just a bit boggled. It's one of those cases of two things that you never expected to be put together being put together, and you don't really know how to react. Like another news story, which I'm sure we'll get to in a minute.
To see a Klingon bride butchering people in like the House of Blue Gacht. I think that'd be fantastic.
Yes, that's exactly what this Star Trek's going to be. It's going to be Quentin Tarantino basically doing his greatest hits, but just in Klingon. That's what it's going to be.
My understanding.
If this ever happens, because I'm skeptical it'll come together. There was, of course, talk after Star Trek Beyond came out that they were going to push ahead with a Star Trek 14 or Star Trek 4, depending on their point of view.
Sure.
With this cast, with the new reboot cast, that would incorporate Chris Hemsworth as George Kirk. There would be
there
some sort of
time
travel thing.
There were those reports,
Star Trek Beyond disappointed at the box office, so I think talk about that just kind of quietly went away. And I think you would need something crazy insane for Paramount to go, okay, this thing that doesn't make us a lot of money initially anyway, we need to go back and do it. And Tarantino being involved, not a huge surprise. I think he has sprinkled references to Star Trek throughout his work, and he certainly has in the past expressed an interest in getting involved with other people's franchises, i.e. James Bond and Casino Royale and all that. He's directed episodes of CSI and ER, so he's not averse to that. I'm intrigued by this, but I do wonder about this idea that a writer's room is being put together right now to come up with the ideas based off Quentin's big idea. That Quentin Tarantino, one of the greatest writers on earth, is going to take other people's ideas. I'm not so sure that's going to work. I think, and he's obviously committed as well to his next movie, his ninth movie, which is this Charles Manson related film that we don't really know that much about at the moment.
No, yeah.
Except it has, it's got a lot of heat. Sony are behind it. They're looking at casting big names in it. And it's going to somehow revolve around the murder of Sharon Tate at the hands of the Manson family. And it has a release date at the moment in the States. The release date at the moment in the States is August 9th, 2019. That is the 50th anniversary to the day of the murder of Sharon Tate. That's and the four other people who were killed on
a
that
little
night.
Bit unpleasant.
Now, if that's a coincidence, okay.
Seems
if
unlikely.
If it's not, it's a little bit icky.
If it's a coincidence, they should shift the film's release date immediately.
And if it's not, they should shift the film's release date immediately.
Quite. Of course, you could see that it's been intended as some sort of weird tribute and the heart's in the right place, but for me, it just the connotations are not great.
No.
But we're still excited about that. And Tarantino, who said all along for a long, long time that he will direct 10 films and then quit. And if his 10th film is the Star Trek movie to end all Star Trek movies...
Wait. Let's not talk about this ending thing. I'm not so sure about that.
Then I'll be fairly happy with that. You know, we'll see how it goes.
I mean, if he has a great idea, then fantastic. I would like to see Star Trek boldly going beyond the Next Generation. That would be super good at this point. Enough with the tinkering around.
Could I just say, they never finished the storyline of Deep Space Nine. I am still sitting here waiting to find out what happens to Sisko. I need to know. Can someone please make this?
Entirely fair.
Who's to say this is, of course, still working with the cast? Who's to say this is the Kirk, Spock, Bones, Scotty
I'm not cast? Saying it is, but I'm just saying I hope it will not...
Tarantino strikes me as an original series man. Yeah, he doesn't strike me as a next gen slash DS9 person.
100%.
But Tarantino working on a movie like this, the Tarantino who, whenever the time Kill Bill came out, spoke to R. Mark Dinning and gave a quote that I will never ever forget about CGM movies. He said, basically, if I want to see something like that, I stick my dick in a Nintendo.
I mean, did someone explain to him that's not how it works?
Yeah.
I really hope they did.
You have controllers, it's fun.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not helpful.
All right.
Anyway, yeah. So, well, you know, it's a certainly an intriguing idea, and if he has an amazing idea, notion for it, then all the better. There is other news, though. I did mention something that was a bizarre mix of things that made no sense on the face of it, and that's Ryan Reynolds starring in Detective Pikachu. Pikachu turns detective and is a sidekick to a tiny child trying to solve a mystery.
I don't know what... to do. Literally, my entire experience of Pokemon is running around the XL at Star Wars Celebration, catching the bastards on the floor in Pokemon Go. That is
I remember
basically
you doing
entire,
that.
Yes. Yeah, that was I flirted with that game for one weekend while we were doing Celebration when we camped the Empire office in Celebration, and I caught a number of Squirtles.
Which you must be so proud.
Is not an STD, and you know it was weird. It was a weird game, and I've stopped playing it.
But this is a weird and delightful prospect, and I kind of look forward to the internet wits who will inevitably dub Deadpool's dialogue onto anything that Ryan Reynolds does in a children's film. But, I mean, that's a thing that's happening, so I don't know what else to say.
Detective Pikachu, you shit-spackled Muppet fart.
That is wrong.
It is so wrong.
In other news, we have Rob Marshall considering the directing job on The Little Mermaid.
That is so wrong.
I mean, you know, I can see why you would. He's an experienced hand with musicals. It will be a musical. We were talking about those before.
Yes.
Dexter Fletcher is otherwise engaged.
Dexter Fletcher directs all musicals at the same time. He has to direct Little Mermaid, Bohemian Rhapsody. That's going to be a 2-3 week job.
Yeah, it'll be
fine. And then Rocket Man, but at the same time.
Well, I can't see why that would be a problem. But Marshall is finishing up on Mary Poppins Returns, even though that's not even due out until Christmas 2018. It would be a re-team with the leading man in that film, Lin-Manuel Miranda. I don't know if we've mentioned him before. We probably haven't. Yeah, we should. He's also working with Alan Menken, obviously, on the music for the film, which Alan Menken originally wrote for the animated movie. So he's going to be adding in some new stuff.
So is he going to be in the film as well?
Who knows?
This is interesting.
He'd make an excellent Sebastian.
You had my attention. Now you have my curiosity. But Rob Marshall, I don't particularly rate as a director. I quite enjoyed Chicago, but I think that's because I like the songs. But I think everything else he's made since has been largely dreadful. Nevertheless, I look forward to Mary Poppins Returns every day is Christmas Eve here at Empire Magazine.
And it will be Christmas Eve by the time that comes out, so hurrah.
Oh my God, everything is coming together. Look at that. It's everything. Just like the Christmas movie of all, Die Hard.
Oh, good Lord.
Extraordinary times.
What else has happened? House of Cards has officially had a spaceyectomy. So that's
indeed
a thing.
Yes.
It's going to continue with Robin Wright at the, well, in the chair, in the office, at the desk.
It's kind of doable from the end of last season. I think that'll work really well.
I mean, honestly, after last season, does anybody care?
If it's Robin Wright in charge, you bet you do.
I mean, and she has long been one of the great things in House of Cards, but the last season was such a mess. I think a lot of the goodwill that series had earned has maybe evaporated.
I think people will care. I think the first episode, at least, of season 6 is probably going to be the most watched episode in the show's history. And you know how it's going to start, right?
With the president being abducted by aliens.
No, with a figure shot from behind who looks a lot like Frank Underwood walking onto a train platform.
Yeah. And then if they don't throw him under a train, they've missed an
opportunity. They've got to literally throw him under the train.
Yeah. Maybe Rooney Mara should come in and do it.
Maybe she should.
To make it quite meta.
Maybe she should.
Yeah.
Spoilers there for season 2 of House of Cards, everybody. But yeah, that's what that is happening as well. Here's some interesting news, okay? So this is... I've just read this for the first time. So Peter Farrelly is going solo. So the Farrelly brothers are becoming the Farrelly brother. And he's directing a film that sounds to me like a lot like he is swinging for an Oscar nom next year. I don't necessarily... I've met Peter Farrelly. We've had him on the podcast. Mm-hmm. He's a fun guy. He's a nice guy. I love a lot of his movies. But I've never really put him together with Oscar nominations. Maybe he saw what Adam McKay did with The Big Short and thought, I want a piece of that action. So the film in question is called Green Book. It's going to star a couple of up-and-coming people that you've never really heard of. Viggo Mortensen. Mahershala Ali. These names ring a bell. Linda Cardellini. Oh, wait, these are famous people. Linda Cardellini, Mahershala Ali, and Viggo Mortensen are all going to star in this film. It is about a true story, Italian-American bouncer in 1962 called Tony Lip, who was hired to drive one of the world's finest jazz pianists, Dr. Don Shirley, on a concert tour through the country. And they experienced racism along the way and people trying to, you know, take advantage of them and attack them and all sorts of stuff. And hey, you know what? A friendship grew and was forged in the fires of that. So this is very intriguing, and Farrelly co-wrote the screenplay. Starts shooting very, very soon. I say keep an eye on this one. Yeah. This is going to be interesting.
Fair enough.
Unless it's a Dumb and Dumber prequel.
I don't think it will be. I just don't think it will be.
But a lot of the Farrelly brothers movies involve road trips. Now I've come to think of it. Interesting. Pull over.
Is it?
It is interesting, Helen.
Okay.
It is interesting. Okay, what else has happened? Just loads and loads of stuff is happening in the world of movies.
Well, James Mangold is directing Elle Fanning in a Patty Hearst film, so we're obviously still waiting for All the Money in the World, which is the other great kidnapping drama of the 70s, obviously a Getty in that case. Patty Hearst was the heiress who was abducted and basically was kind of co-opted or was kind of, I don't know, brainwashed, whatever. Indoctrinated by her captors, basically. So it's a potentially very, very complex and quite interesting
Sounds like
story, I think.
Helsinki Syndrome, as in Helsinki, Sweden. Am I right?
Thanks.
Oh my
James.
God.
Wow. He's going to write the script as well, based on the book. Yes?
I'm intrigued by this because last week it came out that he was going to direct a book based on a kids' film.
A book based on a kid's film.
Wait a minute. A film based on a kid's book. I like to think... See, I just want to make sure you're paying attention, Helen.
Thanks,
looking after
Chris.
The deliberate mistakes. So it's a film based on a kid's book. Do not ask me to remember what that's called.
Brilliant.
But he's also attached, and I thought this was his next film, The Force, which is based on the Don Winslow book about a corrupt MIPD cop and his cabal of equally corrupt MIPD cops. I thought that was going to be the next thing to go for him, but suddenly he's attached to all sorts of things. He's like a limpet, just attaching himself liberally to things. He's on that window right now. Look at him.
I'm not going to look.
Get off, Mangold! Damn you.
Okay, so, I mean, I'm sure he'll be busy with one of them, whichever one goes first.
Yes.
Whichever one the financing comes together for tends to be the one that goes first.
Am I imagining things, or is the Disney Fox thing back on the table now? Because this was there, and then it went away very quickly, and now it seems to have returned.
Yes, it does.
It seems to have returned, and
I thought about this. My knee jerk on this originally was amazing, X-Men in the MCU. And then I started thinking about it, and I thought, I can't imagine a Disney that puts out films like Deadpool or Logan or, you know, adults, because it's just not their thing. And then I started to think about all the badness that could come. No.
I again, if this happens and gets confirmed, we'll discuss it at great length on the podcast when it happens. Again, a lot of people's, and my knee-jerk reaction, and it was mainly just to get some lols on Twitter, was, oh my God, X-Men in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Hulk fighting the Thing, it's all going to happen, it's great! But I actually think it's potentially a bad thing.
It's a terrifying notion in some ways, isn't it? Because, again, much as I too would love X-Men and Avengers together, you could do A versus X. You could do A versus X babies. Anyway, but
note
more
to self,
importantly,
never put Helen in charge of Disney.
No, A versus X babies is hilarious. The
is that like
X-Men
Muppet babies?
No, the X-Men. Well, kind of. Yeah, the X-Men kidnap Bucky Bear, and Cap has to call his friends to try and get Bucky Bear back, and they have a whole fight in the street.
Helen,
it's adorable.
Helen, what's a Bucky Bear?
It's a bear that's like Bucky.
What?
I'm not kidding. It's adorable. A versus X babies. Look it up. That's not the point I'm trying to make. The point I'm trying to make is people are beginning to talk about monopolies again, which is something that was sort of meant to have been sorted out at the end of the 19th century. and we are now in a position as a world, as a society, where we have a tiny number of companies that occupy an enormous role in our lives. This historically has proven bad. And, you know, gradually people are beginning to think that it might be bad. Now, obviously, we love and adore Walt Disney and all who sail in him. But just owning so much of our intellectual headspace is kind of crazy. And there's no way to break that up. A sort of intellectual monopoly like that, there is no precedent for that. And it is incredibly weird to think about. They already own basically our entire childhoods. This would give them the only bits they don't.
Of course, you could argue that it would greatly enrich a certain individual who I would argue does not deserve to be further greatly enriched.
Fair.
Tony Stark.
Yeah, this is true. He'd be rubbing it in. Oh my word! He'll be rolling in it. But yes, let's discuss that as when it happens. Very, very quickly, the girl in the spider's web has found it's Mikael Blomkvist, and that is the star of Borg / McEnroe, Sverrir Gudnason.
So, oh yeah.
Well done, him.
Well done.
And we are delighted, of course, by news that Alice Eve has joined the cast of Marvel's Iron Fist Season 2, in which Danny Rand, the immortal Iron Fist, goes around telling people that he is Danny Rand, the immortal Iron Fist, until someone punches him repeatedly in the face.
That sounds ideal, actually.
Alice Eve will punch him in the face.
It does sound credible, certainly. And it does seem that Iron Fist really is immortal if he got a second season.
Yeah.
Even on Netflix, my goodness.
He should be dead, and yet he's not.
How do they not spot this? Kurt Russell's going to play Santa Claus.
I know, and so you've got a new contender for most Christmassy film of all time.
Ho, ho, ho. Get that in a t-shirt. Right, so it's a live-action movie, he's going to be Santa Claus, and it's going to be the greatest movie ever made. So there you go. That's what it says here.
that's really what it says. Show me your screen, Chris.
I hope it's... Oh my God, I want it to be Santa Claus and his elves are being slowly taken over one by one. They're being assimilated by this alien thing.
A
thing, who knows. And then Disney buy the thing and they start fighting the Hulk and it all kicks off and the end is Santa Claus sitting in his burning compound drinking some whiskey.
And laughing.
While Mrs. Claus, and they're just going to say, yeah, let's just wait here for a little while. See what happens.
Your mind is a strange place.
All right, time now for our last guests this week, and they are Double Trouble. They are the brothers Franco, Dave and James. They have known each other since Dave was born.
Wow.
Pretty much, yeah.
It's a long-standing relationship.
When did you first meet your brother, Dave Franco? They are teaming up this week on The Disaster Artist, which is the tale of how Tommy Wiseau made The Room, which is widely considered to be one of the worst, and maybe even the worst movies ever made. But that tale of adversity has been turned into a tale of weird triumph with The Disaster Artist, which has been tipped for Oscars, not least, of course, with James Franco, who also directed the film as well. John Nugent spoke to them both when they came into London just a couple of weeks ago. Do enjoy the interview.
James Franco and Dave Franco, welcome to the Empire Podcast.
Thank you.
How are you doing, both? Everything's great, man.
Yeah.
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 We are here to talk about The Disaster Artist, which is the first collaboration between the two of you. Why is that? Like, why? What's taking it so long?
Yeah, Dave, what's taking it?
Yeah, this is on me. No, just when I was first starting out, I did make a choice to go off on my own in regards to work stuff, just because I wanted to pave my own path and I wanted to just do my own thing and not be referred to as James Franco's little brother for the rest of my life. And so I feel like I hopefully did that. And it just felt like the right timing and the right project and the right dynamic between these characters. We really understood them, and I'm so glad that I did say yes, just because it ended up being one of the more enjoyable experiences I've had on set.
Yeah. Now I have to hear, like, oh, I love your brother.
You don't hear that
Oh,
long.
Yeah, I hear it all the time.
But I bet your mum must be happy that you're finally, like, playing together, right?
She just came to the premiere, and, yeah, I sat one seat away from her, and there were sounds. She was making
sat next to her. She was just, I mean, when the entire audience was silent, she was just squealing. And there were just so many emotions going through her. She didn't know how to process it all.
So for those who don't know, then this is about The Room, which is obviously famously the world's, many people think is the world's worst film.
Best worst film,
yes, yeah. And so where did you...
Which means it's very watchable.
It's very watchable. So I'm assuming you guys have watched it many times over, right? Like, what was your first...
Probably more than any other film. Yeah.
Really?
Absolutely.
Wow, what does that do to your psyche when you've seen
weirdly enough
more than good films?
But yeah. Here's the thing, you're right. I remember Don Cheadle just introduced a screening of our film, The Disaster Artist, and he talked about Kristen Bell, who was on his show, mm-hmm. holding these room screenings. Kristen Bell, by the way, is like the biggest Room fan. She's probably seen it 100 times.
Yeah.
And he kept saying to her, like, I don't want to see it if it's just bad. Like, that's going to depress me. Like, if it's just bad. And I can kind of understand, because sometimes when I see a bad film, like, when I see a good film, it inspires me. And you think, you know, optimistically, like, oh, wow, I can do that. Or I want to reach for that.
Yeah.
And then when you see a bad film, you think, oh, wait, is that what my stuff comes off like, you know what I mean? Nobody wants to make a bad film. Nobody goes into a film thinking they're going to make a bad one, you know, except, you know, sometimes people will do like something campy on purpose or something. But when people are really trying, they're trying to make something good.
Yeah.
And I can see the magic behind The Room. And a lot of that is because I know the story behind it. I've read the book, The Disaster Artist, and Greg Sestero, the other actor in The Room, and this journalist, Tom Bissell, wrote this incredible book. And so even though The Room didn't turn out like Tommy intended, I know all the effort and sweat and passion and heart and soul that went into the making of it, and I can really appreciate it for that.
Because the film, The Disaster Artist, is kind of, it's not just about how this film is made, but it's also about, like, you know, the joy of filmmaking and Hollywood and the creative process.
Exactly, which is, you know, can be applied to the making of any movie,
right,
of our favorite movies. You know, the same amount of passion is involved. It's just that Tommy used that passion to fuel a bunch of strange, odd decisions.
Right.
The behind the scenes of The Room that we portray in our film is just a small section of the film. Mm. And ultimately, we knew the challenge from the get-go was, how are we going to make our movie appeal to people who have never even heard of The Room? Mm-hmm. And because we have this story of friendship and dreamers surrounding everything, we had, you know, that's a very relatable thing that anyone who has ever tried to make it in the arts can latch onto.
Yeah, absolutely. So then Greg, Dave, you play Greg, and James, you play Tommy.
Tommy, yeah. Tommy Wiseau.
So, I mean, can you tell me how you developed that sort of weird Eastern European accent? He sort of sounds like he's got a frog in his throat the whole time.
Tommy sound like this, then you'd guess it was from Eastern Europe, but he said he's from New Orleans, all American accent and all American guy. And it is sort of Eastern European, but it's like it's yeah. been distorted by, you know, him trying to get rid of it, of whatever, I don't know, whatever the course of, you know, his life took him on. But so the only way to really get it was to go to the source. Now, right. The Room is actually all redubbed. And you'd think a guy that was like trying to get rid of his Eastern European accent, if he was dubbing the whole thing, he would do a better job than he had done. But he sounded like this in the whole movie. Oh, hi, Mark. You know, oh, hi, doggy.
You can imagine what it sounded like originally.
Yeah.
And but I also had this piece of preparation gold. Tommy used to drive around in his car and talk to himself on a mini recorder.
Oh, wow.
And 20 years ago, his good friend Greg stole a bunch of these tapes.
As good friends do.
And digitized them. And so when I got ready to play Tommy, he gave those recordings to me, and I would listen to them over and over and just, you know, repeat the back what Tommy was saying to himself. And so it really helped getting the voice down. But in addition, it gave me a real insight into Tommy's sort of private world. Now, Tommy knows I have the tapes. He calls them a secret tape. I know you have them, James, you know. But, and in addition, you know, Tommy is like, he's just fun to do. Like, everybody wants to do Tommy. I remember reading the book for the first time aloud to my friends and assistant, and we would, you know, switch off reading aloud to each other. And everybody just had loved doing the Tommy voice. It's just, it's like the new Tony Montana or something,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
Everybody's got their own version of it.
So Tommy and Greg, they fully participated in this movie, right? They gave permission for their rights. And did you spoke to them beforehand? Was there, like, what was the most surprising thing you learned from speaking to them?
Yeah, I was able to speak with Greg a few times before we started filming. And then he was on set throughout the entire production. And I picked his brain about everything, but I was specifically curious why he was drawn to Tommy in the first place and why he stuck with him through this crazy journey for as long as he did. And Greg talked a lot about how when he was a young actor, everyone in his life was telling him that he wasn't going to make it, that this was an impossible goal. And then he met Tommy, who encouraged him and believed in him. And so Greg found this teammate and like this ally, where when you're a young actor, that's invaluable. And like, that's something I can absolutely relate to. And then I also was curious if during production of The Room, Greg ever believed that The Room could be a good film. And he claims he didn't, but I don't fully believe him, just because, again, as a young actor, it's the most exciting thing in the world just to get on set. And so once you're on set, it's like you almost have to have this blind optimism and hope that things are going to turn out great, even though everyone from the outside can see that what you're working on is objectively bad. And I've been in those scenarios where I've been working on things that I thought were going really well, and people on set were talking about awards, and I bought into the hype, and then the movie came out, and not only was it not good, it was a piece of shit. And so you just go into it, and you put everything you have into a project, and you just never know which way it's going to go.
And then, like The Room, you had the billboards in LA, right? You had the...
Yeah. When Tommy paid for The Room, it cost $6 million.
Yeah.
Part of that was because he just bought all the equipment unnecessarily, and the lights and cameras and everything.
Yeah.
But he also distributed it and paid for this billboard that was this fixture in LA for 5 years. And yeah, so that's hundreds of thousands of dollars right there to keep that billboard up that long. Yeah. And it was very odd. It was his face with the lazy eyelids glaring down at you, and it said The Room, and there was a phone number. I remember passing it hundreds of times and just really not understanding what it was, you know, because what movie billboard has a phone number on it? And anyway, A24 in the States has now recreated that billboard, but with my photo as Tommy and a new phone number.
Right.
That might go to Tommy, might go to me, who knows.
So you have that cell phone then?
Somebody has it.
Have you received any phone calls?
There have been over 100,000 phone calls. Wow. Maybe 200,000.
I mean, what is the purpose of... I mean, I'm curious what Tommy thought the purpose of the phone was. Like, what's...
The original phone number, I learned, went directly to his apartment. And he would tell you, you know, go see the room at sunset 5 at midnight. But he would also... And sometimes he would... keep people on the line and talk to them for hours about, you know, his next movie deal or whatever, you know, getting into the new Star Wars movie or something. Yeah. And it was, I think, a way to connect to his fans.
Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So your film, I think it was an unfinished cut, but it premiered at South by Southwest, right?
Yes.
At the midnight screening. Yes. I mean, what was that like? Because I read reports that said it was pretty electric screening.
That was the best screening either of us will ever experience in our lives. Yeah, it was... what can I say? I mean, going into it, I almost didn't feel nervous just because there were too many huge expectations of our movie at the time. And we loved it. And, you know, that's... What else can you ask for? And so we went in it not knowing how people were going to react. We figured South By would be the perfect audience for it because it's a bunch of film lovers and they go into these movies wanting to have a good time. But it ended up being just like a rock concert, like to the point where you couldn't hear half of the lines. But yeah, I mean, I don't even have a second place in terms of like best experiences of premiering a movie of my own.
Yeah, for sure. It was the screening of a lifetime. Standing ovation. It was also the first time that Tommy saw the film.
Oh, wow.
And so even though we were, you know, so happy with the response, we kept looking down the row at Tommy to gauge his reaction. And he was pretty subdued. He wasn't really laughing that much during the movie.
Did he watch the whole movie with his sunglasses on?
Yeah, he wears shades, even when he's in the movie theater.
So he may not have seen the full movie.
Yeah, who knows what he saw, but whatever kind of seeped through, yeah. I asked him afterwards, I was like, so what do you think? And he's like, well, I approve 99.9%. And
okay.
I was kind of a relief.
Yeah.
And I was like, what's the 0.1%? He's like, well, you know, you think he'd be like, I never said that. I never did. But he said, I think you should look at lighting in the beginning of film a little off. And it's like, all right, I'll tell Brandon, my DP, to go look at the room.
Well, now we're just remembering that he watched it through his sunglasses.
Yeah.
He's definitely going to be off.
Was it a little dark?
Yeah, the whole film was really dark. Yeah.
Very dark.
And then tonight, you're doing a Q&A at the Prince Charles, which is the London home of The Room.
Well, Greg, the real Greg and Tommy have told us that the best audience in the world for The Room is at the Prince Charles.
Yeah.
And so that's where we're premiering our movie here.
Yeah. I mean, if there's any audience you need to prove it to, it's this one, right? I mean,
absolutely. I mean,
I'm pretty confident. You know, there's been a lot of hardcore Room fans that have come to our movie, and I think they leave very satisfied.
Yeah.
Because we honor the strangeness of The Room, but we give you more. We give you the heart behind it.
Absolutely. Well, that's a perfect moment on which to end, I think.
All right.
Guys, all right. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, man. Thank you.
Okay, so that was the Brothers Franco. We'll get on to the Disaster Artist in just a few minutes. But first up is Stronger, which is another Oscar contender starring Jake Gyllenhaal as Jeff Bauman, who lost his legs in the Boston Marathon bombing a few years ago. And it's a tale of how he gets himself back to full health, mental and physical, with the help of his fiance, played by Tatiana Maslany. Helen, what did you think of this?
I was a bit mixed on this one. It's from David Gordon Green, and I think it first of all, it's much better than Patriots Day for me. I think it's a much more nuanced and smarter take on the bombings as they affected regular people, which of course was not what Patriots Day was trying to do. But Yeah, so Gyllenhaal is on fantastic form as Jeff. He is like absolutely average guy, you know, good heart, tries his best, maybe isn't quite succeeding in life as much as he wants to, but he's kind of getting by, trying to get his ex-girlfriend back. So he goes out to support her as she's doing the Boston Marathon. And that is obviously Tatiana Maslany, who from Orphan Black, who is one of the most phenomenal actresses today. If you see her in that show, it's incredible. Her 18 different performances in it.
Is that all?
Hmm?
Is that all?
At least. Ooh. And sometimes she plays one of the clones disguised as another clone, and you can still tell which clone it is, even though she looks exactly... Anyway, it's amazing.
She sticks her hair back. It's what you do.
Uh-huh.
How you differentiate.
Sure. But it's a weird film, this, because I think what it's trying to do is, on one hand, it's trying to be the inspirational tale of overcoming adversity and, you know, the incredible trials that Jeff went through and the way that he generally greeted those with enormously inspiring determination and strength and character and humour. You know, he has absolutely low moments and he manages to get through them, often with Erin's help. The problem for me is it also kind of wants to have its cake and eat it and sort of point out the fact that he's not just an inspiring tale. He is a real person. This isn't just this isn't something that should have happened and something that he can kind of easily overcome. And it's a weird film that seems to be trying to serve two masters at once. It seems to be trying to be the inspiring, sincere, straightforward movie, but also kind of undermine that and undercut it, and I get what they're trying to do, and I think it's very worthy. I just don't know that it always sits together brilliantly.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you there. I felt it was a little bit more effective than that, a little bit more successful, but that's largely down to the performances, which are really, really great. It does seem to have fallen away in the Oscar race. I thought for sure Jake Gyllenhaal would be a contender for Best Actor. I don't really see his name mentioned that much, but he really goes for it in this movie.
He does.
He really
yeah.
gives it his all. Tatiana Maslany is also very good, as is Miranda Richardson as his mum, who is a very, very down to earth Bostonian. Really good accent as well, but you expect that from Miranda Richardson. She's fantastic. But Jake Gyllenhaal, this is a performance, you know, he really captures the mental and physical atrophying that I think Jeff Bauman underwent. There's one sequence where he's crawling after his girlfriend, which is just absolutely... She may be his wife by that point, actually.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely heartrending. And he's fully, completely and utterly committed, as he was with the likes of Southpaw and Nightcrawler.
Sure.
I don't know necessarily that it is going to result in an Oscar nomination, but he is very, very good. And if you're going to go see it, it is quite uplifting, I think, ultimately. It is quite affecting, but its decision to remove itself, I think, emotionally as much as you can, and not to tread through the cornfield of cliches. Is that a cliche in itself? I don't know. I've never heard that before. Cornfield.
I think
of
you're
cliches.
Okay.
I think I just coined that. Am I a genius? I think I am. The yes. decision not to do that is, I think, ultimately maybe detrimental to the film in a weird way. But still, good stuff. Well acted. Three stars in for Stronger. Which brings us on to The Disaster Artist, which may see James Franco nominated again for Best Actor.
It could do, yes. So this is the tale of the making of The Room, famously possibly the worst film of all time, certainly a really bad one.
I've never seen it.
I have to confess I haven't either, but you get enough from this film that I don't think that's necessarily a handicap.
Mm.
Although I hear great things about, for example, the Prince Charles midnight screenings and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
They have a regular room slot. Apparently you should throw spoons at the screen. I don't know. Anyway, so this is the story of the making of, and James Franco plays Tommy Wiseau, who's the director of the film. Dave Franco plays Greg Sestero, who becomes his sort of leading man and best friend, and they very sincerely tell the story of this completely bizarre guy trying to make his film, and they sort of take him seriously-ish, mostly, and, you know, say that he really intended to make a great film, and he just couldn't, maybe. There is a little bit of snark creeps in. That's mostly through Seth Rogen's character. If you've seen the trailer, you'll know exactly what I mean.
Yeah.
So you can see that people were aware that this was disastrous. Mm-hmm. But it's a really interesting mix of drama, and it's kind of tragicomic actually, because you feel for the characters and you want them to succeed, and you know that they absolutely won't. And yet there are moments of just complete madness that you can't help but laugh at. So it's a pretty fine tightrope that they've walked here, and I think they've done it really, really impressively. John in his review said it's La La Land for losers, which I think is not unfair. Yeah, it's pretty good stuff.
Makes you want to walk on air and make a bad film.
It sort of does, but it's a sweet sort of a tribute to a massive failure.
It's a weird companion piece to the Jim Carrey documentary, the Jim and Andy documentary, which came out, because that's a film that makes you want to watch another film. It's a film you watch that and you go, oh, I want to revisit Man on the Moon now. And even The Truman Show, which I rewatched recently because of that documentary. And I think it's the same with this. I do want to watch The Room now, which I've never, ever wanted to do before. but I am scared, so hold me. So 4 stars for The Disaster Artist. And then the last film this week, only I've seen it in this room, and it is Takashi Miike's 100th movie as director. He is incredibly prolific.
Talk
he is the director of Audition and Ichi the Killer and The Happiness of the Katakuris and 97 other movies. This is 100th, and this is a fantastic martial arts epic. It's about Manji, who's a samurai warrior played by Takuya Kimura, and he at the beginning of the movie loses his sister to an evil warlord, and he is himself run through with swords. But he is imbued with a curse by or blessing, who knows, by an old lady, that basically he will live forever. He has these worms that he puts into his blood system, and they basically suck out any wounds that he gets. He lives for a long time, and he then finds himself assisting a young girl many years later who reminds him of his sister. So much so, in fact, she's played by the same actress. And he gets involved in a battle with an equally evil tyrant. And some of the fight sequences in this, some of the battle sequences in this are absolutely astonishing. Really, really great. I reviewed it for the magazine. I gave it 4 stars. This is really, really good stuff, along the lines of 13 Assassins. So go and see it. Blade of the Immortal. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for the last podcast
of...
Oh, yeah, I should finish a sentence, shouldn't I?
Thank God.
The last podcast of 2017, when we'll be joined by... Who are we going to be joined by?
Somebody huge, I hope.
Someone who's into huge action.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Probably nothing.
That's right. It's Jack Human. We'll be joined by him. And we're going to be joined by Karen Gillan as well. That's not a bad way to go out in 2017.
It's pretty sweet.
And then after that, we're going to have a Review of the Year podcast. That'll probably be the week after as well. So we're not going to leave you completely for a couple of weeks, but we are knocking off because I've got to go and fight thieves taking over the Nakatomi Plaza.
That's not how Christmas works.
I think you'll find it is exactly how Christmas works.
Precisely. And until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It is goodbye from James.
Happy trails, Hans.
Have you enjoyed the last 10 minutes?
Yes. I've been sitting here looking at things on my phone while you talk about films I haven't seen. They sound great, though. I'm definitely going to go and see all of the ones you talked about.
What do we talk about?
The films.
Okay, good.
The ones
excellent.
That are out.
Good to see you. Someone's paying attention. And it is goodbye from me. I am off to buy a suit from John Phillips, London.
Rumour has it, Arafat buys his there.
Merry Christmas, everybody. See you next week. Bye.